Welcome to Book Reporter Talks To, a podcast from the Book Report Network, where we host in-depth conversations with authors about the books that we love. We know authors cannot travel everywhere, so we want to bring them to you, wherever you may be. Welcome to our latest Book Reporter Talks To interview, where our guest today is Kate Morton. And we're going to be talking about Homecoming, which was an instant New York Times bestseller and got so many other accolades. And it's going to be a Book Reporter Bets On selection as well. I love this book. Our reviewer, Kate Ayers, had this to say about it. Homecoming challenges readers to figure out who was involved in the deaths of four people. And it goes beyond. Would you have done the same? Would you forgive? Would you understand? And once again, Morton proves she's hailed as one of the best. Now, I want you to know, I just finished this book this morning. Okay, I just finished it. I said to everybody, I'm not coming until like 11. I'm going to finish the book. And I don't know if you can see how many folded down pages I have here. I'm trying to get a good angle on this. How many pages I folded down of things I wanted to talk about with this book? So welcome, Kate. It's so nice to see you again. I can't believe it's been 5 years. Really?
Carol, I can't believe it either. It is such a pleasure to be with you and to talk books.
And to talk books, which is going to be even more fun. So let's begin by you giving us an overview of Homecoming and what inspired you to write it.
Okay. Always the most challenging thing to do, but I'm going to do my best. Homecoming is about a woman named Jess who is called back from her life in London to her hometown of Sydney when her beloved grandmother, Nora, suffers a serious fall and is taken to hospital. Now, at Nora's house, Jess discovers an old book of true crime chronicling the police investigation into a shocking murder in 1959 in a small town in South Australia. And she also realizes a link to a secret in her family's past. Now, I was actually working on a different manuscript which was going to be my seventh book, best laid plans and all of that. When in March 2020, not to linger on the pandemic, the pandemic struck and my family and I were living in London, a lot like Jess, and we decided, because flights were being cancelled, that we'd take our Easter flight a little early, go home to Australia, see our family and return to London in summer when the pandemic was over. But it didn't work out that way, as we all know. And we ended up unexpectedly living back in Australia. Having left urban London, we were in a sort of remote rural South Australia. And I just completely fell out of the manuscript I'd been working on. It seemed so far away, both geographically, because it was set in Europe, but also emotionally, mentally. And instead, the world that I was in, this sort of farm in South Australia, became so vivid as the rest of world events swirled around me that I found new ideas coming and really sort of tapping me on the shoulder and conjuring themselves to life out of the actual world that I found myself in. And so Homecoming was born.
Wow. And you know, what's really interesting when we talk about the pandemic, we always talk about the negative of people. Mm-hmm. Yes, people died, people were sick, people, whatever. We also find a renewed use of self because there were so many things we couldn't do. But what could you do? You could look around at places. You could spend time with your family. You could play board games. You could do all these things that you just never had time for before. And you sort of wondered why you didn't have time as you were going on. And my cousin actually had a really good line. She said, when the pandemic hit, you took everything out of your basket. And now you're deciding what to put back in and what you love and what you want to continue to do. So you're in this remote part of South Australia with children who are going to school, I take it remotely.
Yes. And in fact, because we had come from London, they were doing remote school via their schools in London, which meant logging on at 6 o'clock at night and working through till 1 a.m., which meant our days, so we'd left late winter and we were in late summer. So I remember it as this sort of long, sunny, hazy, dusty end of summer sort of stillness in the middle of the swirling world. In fact, I kept on having the T.S. Eliot line from Bernd Norton, the still point in the turning world kept coming into my head because that's where I felt we were. And it, as you say, it was the rubbing out, the erasing of all of those daily routines that we all do without thinking, get up, make school lunches, go to school, you have no control over those aspects of your life because you do them every day and you have to, so you don't even think about them. And all of a sudden they fell away. And so the days really were a completely different shape and color. And for me, given the location we're in, that is, that did start to feed my imagination. And, the small day trips we took when we were finally allowed to leave the house and out of quarantine, also, I can see looking back now that they were full of the seeds that grew into the idea behind homecoming.
Yeah, because you were actually able to feel things because you weren't rushing to do the next thing. So writing during the pandemic, what was that like? Did you have more time, or you were juggling their schedules? If you wrote at night, they were at school. But what was it like to try to, juggle that around?
Well, it was the most difficult thing about writing during the pandemic for me was the distraction of the real world, because the news was changing daily. And it's difficult to remember now, but it was all every day there was something new and strange ways to live. I mean, I remember an Easter where we were restricted in how many people could come to our house to, from our family to have Easter. And that just seems unfathomable now that we were living by these strange rules and changing all the time. So that was a distraction. And I am someone who likes to know what's happening in the world and to follow the news. And so it was difficult to escape that tick of checking in. But once I did, I'm a very focused writer in so far as I could sit in the middle of a group of 1,000 people, and so long as I had my work, my laptop or my notebook, I can tunnel into it. And I suppose that's an extension of having always had children ever since I became a writer. So I've always had to work in the cracks of time, and that's not a problem for me.
No, it's just like, okay, let's just do this. You say that homecoming draws most closely on the landscape that inspired it. Many of the sights, smells, and sounds you'll find within these pages are from my own life, even if the events did not occur. Do you think that the pandemic, that was giving us this time to like stop and see these kinds of things and actually notice this world around you, especially since you're in such a different place than being in an urban area? And you can go out and take a walk and see flowers that are different from what you would have seen in England.
Yeah, absolutely. And landscape and vegetation and things that I, because I am Australian, took for granted. I mean, they were that part of the landscape of my childhood, my life. So I was seeing them afresh because I had been living in London for 5 years. And all of a sudden, there was that time to walk down the very quiet country road and with wattles or mimosa planted all the way along, and to really smell what that smells like when they start to flower at the end of August here. And so some of the scenes, for instance, in the prologue when Percy is riding his horse and he lies down and feels the warmth of the sun through his shirt, and he smells the wattle, the golden wattle flowers. That's drawn directly, not the horse part, but directly from my real life. I felt that sun and smelled those smells. And it was such a joy to put those things that are familiar to me into a book and sort of send them out into the world to be read by people who perhaps had not walked down a country lane in Australia and smelled those smells and seen the stark silver white of the dead straight gum trees standing on the ridge of the hill across the way. I just loved bringing those to life for readers.
I love that when you see that there's, let's say, decorative vegetation around a house, and then there's the wild that's just beyond. So you're like cultivating this, but right beyond it is something you have no control over. And I think that when I was reading the book, I was thinking of that. They're out in an area where, yes, it's their land, but it's not their land where it's mowed or taken care of quite the same way. Like, let's go down to the water, let's go do this. It's very different.
Absolutely. And in fact, that juxtaposition is something that I really tried to incorporate into the book. And at one point, Nora, one of the characters who we meet as an elderly woman in the present, but who is a young woman in the historical storyline, visits her brother's house, which is in the Adelaide Hills. And she has exactly that experience of realizing that what he loves about it particularly is to stand on the veranda of his grand old replica Georgian house, which is an odd thing in itself to have transplanted into the Australian landscape. And he looks across this beautiful cultivated garden that surrounds the house, but across the valley and up, you know, there's the upsweep of a hill where there isn't a cultivated garden. And in fact, it's the natural Australian landscape where at the end of summer, the grasses have been bleached to, you know, almost white. And then up on the top of the hill, the gum trees. I mean, that's an actual view that I have experienced in my real life. And that juxtaposition is uncanny. And when I, you know, thinking about a book where a lot of the ideas and themes I was thinking about were about home and belonging and whether you can feel at home in more than one place and whether an English character like Isabel in Homecoming can come and ever feel at home in Australia, the architecture that has been transplanted from one place to another, standing there in this natural ancient landscape was something that gave me a real, that sort of thrill when I was writing, where I sort of know I'm on the right track of the ideas that I want to explore.
Exactly. And that's the way we were feeling. I felt like I was there. So we're going to turn to the Turner family tragedy of 1959, which is one of the storylines in the book. And it still haunts this town in December 2018. This is almost 60 years later. And I love you start on December 7th, which is my birthday. So like, okay, I'll go. Also, I know it's before the pandemic, very smart, go to December 2018. And it's because the town lore is what happened to the Turners, like what happened to these people. And we begin to learn their secrets. Did you know from the start, or did you see that as time went on? Did you know we're going to all see this at the end and I see exactly what happened? Or were you saying something happened and we'll get there and figure out what it did, what it was?
I knew what had happened. I didn't know all of the ins and outs of who, and I didn't know how. So writing a book takes a certain amount of faith. And for me, you know, I saw this Perseus prologue. It just was in my mind so vividly. And I saw this because he's making a journey home in Christmas Eve, 1959. He's on horseback. He's coming through rural Australia and he takes the horse for a swim because it's so hot. Down in the creek, which runs along the edge of a sort of grand estate in on the outskirts of this little country town. And he comes across a quite shocking scene. And I saw the scene beneath the willow so vividly, and the mysterious aspect of it, the uncanny idea that it was inexplicable. How had this happened? I really, really was excited by that idea. But I didn't know how. And it was only as I was sort of, you know, quite a way in that I thought, well, I really do have to work out a practical way that could happen. And you know, it's quite important that this really could happen. And that's where, you know, that's where, as I say, the faith comes into it, the sort of believing that you will find what happened and the way that it all came about.
I loved it. Like you could see the ants crawling on the little girl's arm. Like she's sitting there. So you knew that they were dead, but it was okay. You're like, how did it happen? Where? And it's just this real, it's like what I call a cold open. Like you're there. And then, okay, how are we going to go from there? And you could see it was a film. It's the cold open. And we're so used to watching things right now that I feel like authors have had to get more visual in what they're doing, because that's what the reader is expecting at this point, is to have a layout of what is going to happen in the story and see it.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And in fact, I have a theory that unless they grew up in a more sort of Amish situation, most writers of, say, our generation write in a filmic way anyway, because so much of the storytelling we received growing up, it was visual. And I know I see things that way. So it's, you know, I will see the long shot of the car driving along the driveway towards the big house. Then I'll see the close-up of the, you know, the door opening and the foot landing on the gravel as the person hops out. And then I'll see the shot up the stairs as if I'm in the viewpoint of the character, and then the hand on the doorknob, or whatever the case. You don't even realize that you see things in these sorts of close-ups, long shots, etc.
And what I find is that some authors don't deliver on it, but with yours, we were in that cinematic moment. We were in that reading cinematic moment. And some people deliver on a part of the book, but it doesn't carry all the way through. But here I felt like I was as part of the scene. I felt like I was part of, like, you know, what was happening. You know, there are clues that they all seem to head nowhere until they all come together. And did you see when they, where were they headed as you were writing, or were they unfolding for you too? Like, oh, and we can't give anything away, which is very, very difficult about talking about this book, but that's exactly what we're doing.
Lots of it I do know. So I'm very much a mix between a plotter and a panther. So I do months and months of thinking before I even sit down and type chapter one. And in that time, it's wonderful. It's the dreaming time. It's the play time, like being a child, where everything is possible and I haven't yet been limited by my own ability to put things into words. And when I'm doing that, idea threads come together, the tapestry of the book starts to come to life, and I really get a feel for the place, the characters, the situation, how readers are going to feel, how I'm going to feel. And at a certain point, I am compelled to start. I have to, because it's so vivid and I need to start getting it down. And that's when I start to write. So I have a pretty good idea of where it's going and how. But of course, I mean, my books are long and there's so many layers. And so lots of things happen along the way. And people talk about, you know, the magic of writing. And I'm always a little bit hesitant to use the word because it sounds, you know, unbelievable. But I think the unconscious magic, whatever you want to call it, has a pretty large part to play, because often I will get towards the end and, you know, things are starting to snowball and the writing is coming together faster and faster. And elements that I put in at the beginning that I knew belonged, I suddenly realize have this vital role to play. And I don't know whether that's the unconscious knowing from the beginning, or whether because I put it there and it became a real part of the story, you know, it sticks in my mind and I write towards needing it. But whatever the case, these little elements so often end up having been exactly where you need them to be when you reach the end.
And there are no little empty threads. Like, there were no threads that I was like, oh, we didn't wrap this up. You've also got conflict in the book, and it's beginning with Jess and her mom, Polly, who are quite estranged from each other. And for Jess, she begins to wonder what her grandmother was doing going up to the attic when she fell and why she was attempting to go there. And do you write the possible conflicts out first and then develop them? Because there's definitely a conflict. But Polly and Jess have not spent much time together at all. And Jess was raised by her grandmother, and she's summoned back because they said, you know, you need to come now. Your grandmother's not in good shape. You need to come. And she sees this woman she remembered as strong, as frail, and in this bed. And it's like completely turned her head on who is this person and what was she doing and why. So the conflict is there. So did you love to do that? It's just like, we're in the conflict, folks.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's, you want to sort of begin in the middle of things. And I was very glad to do that. But I, from the beginning with this book, characters are always very important to me, but I was very conscious of wanting to write about stories and storytelling and who gets to tell stories and why we believe the things we do about our family. And so I wanted to take that all the way down to the characters, so that we as readers meet the characters through one point of view, through one particular character's point of view. And then I wanted to be able to flip that at a certain point in the book, so that you, characters you've heard about, and so you know, you trust the narrator who's telling you what that person's like, you suddenly see through their own point of view or through someone else's and realize that there are multiple ways of looking at the same set of events. And that was something I was aware of, particularly in this sort of family story where one of the ideas is about motherhood and what makes a good mother, and there are varying views on that and who has performed in those roles, you know, as there are in real life when we talk about experiences that we've had with another person that we all see from different perspectives. So that was something that I really was conscious of wanting to weave into the book.
And it was there early. It was like, we didn't wait for that. It was, she was stunned about Jess. Her mother comes in and she doesn't really know her as a mother. She knows her as another person in her life. And then all of a sudden, to watch them begin to trust each other and to trust what's going to happen. And they have to come together to do that, because they each have pieces of knowledge that are going to get them to what happens. So I well, love the I way. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, I think the Donora, the sort of grand matriarch of the family, has performed the role, which is quite usual, I suppose, for a character of her stature within the family, of being the storyteller. She has been in charge of telling not just the family stories to both her daughter Polly and her granddaughter Jess, but also telling them who they are. And so forming their identities. And I think once she is removed through injury and the other two characters are brought back into each other's sphere, we start to see that there are perhaps other ways at looking at the stories that she's been telling them about their family and also about themselves.
About each other. This is who Polly is and this is who Jess is. And now all of a sudden they're like, well, wait a second, that's not really who I am completely. And who am I going to be with you? And I think that was you really got to the end pages of the book before you saw Jess and Polly really together, to that last, I say, like 10th of the book, if I was counting pages, and you really see what you're doing. You know, I love the way you do a turn of a phrase. And when people ask me what genre your book is in, I would say it's one you want to read. Like, that's it. That's the genre. It's one you want to read.
I was going to say, if you can work out what genre, can you tell me? But people always ask. It's like, well, it's a bit of everything.
I said, seriously, it's a bit of brilliant descriptive writing, family suspense, mystery, and here too, true crime. And shelving it in a store is going to be interesting. And I take it's not the first time you've heard this, but what's really... it is really just go read this. And, you know, some people are intimidated by a big book. I mean, I find these days that people's attention span is about, like, you know, maybe not even the nightly news. I mean, not, they want little bits and bites. When you settle in with this, it's the kind of book that you take on vacation and you just sit and read and escape with. And I can't figure out what the shelving would be either, because you've got true crime in here, you've got mystery, you've got family, but very literary, lush writing at the same time. It's not just shoot them up and move. It's, this is how it happened, and now we got to figure it out. So I take it you've heard that before.
Well, you know what? When I first started out as a writer and decided to write my first manuscript, I was in my early 20s, and I was very prescriptive. I really liked reading mystery and crime books, and so I sort of looked and almost did a paint-by-numbers script of what I was going to do. And I wrote a couple of manuscripts like that that were shown to publishers and went nowhere. And then I had my first baby, my son, who's now nearly 20.
Oh, gosh.
And I decided, you know, I had been at university and suddenly I wasn't. And my life felt so different. And I thought, well, I'm never going to be a published author. And that's okay. I just love writing. So I'm going to forget about genre and where a book would be shelved in the bookstore. And I'm just going to write something for myself. And I actually still have the notebook where I actually wrote a list, things like, it's going to have the past and the present. It's going to have a big old house that feels like a character. It's going to have families and secrets and, like, the sort of book where you'd need a family tree because of the generations, etc. All these things are listed. And, you know, what do I like? Well, I like old peeling wallpaper, and I like tiles falling off the edge of old waterfalls in water features in gardens that have been abandoned. And I actually wrote this list and I started writing, and I thought, this is great. No one else is ever going to read this. It's just for me. It's exactly my taste. And that's the manuscript that became The House at Riverton. So the moral of the story, I guess, is write what you love, because then you will convey some sort of authentic passion to readers. But yeah, so from that very beginning, it doesn't have a genre. It's a list.
It's a list. It's like, these are all the places you do, you know? And, like, true crime is so popular today. So including a true crime book, which is called As If They Were Asleep. Like, when those people, the people I talked about before, they found them, it was as if they were asleep. The Turners makes the storytelling more interesting. So do you enjoy reading and watching true crime and reading about it? Because I'm, like, addicted, I have to say.
Yeah, I am really interested, because I love, you know, I love a mystery, and I love to know why people do the things they do. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot there for me to enjoy. The funny thing, it's now in retrospect, it seems so purposeful to have included a true crime book, because of course with podcasts and streaming, there's so much true crime. And, you know, it wasn't even in my mind when I made the decision. I'm always looking for ways to incorporate an historical storyline, but I get bored if I do the same thing over and over again. So I thought, well, this is a way to do it. And I'll tell the historical storyline through this book within the book. And it seems so naive of me now, because I started doing that. And I was a chapter or two into it before I thought, well, this is just the author's, the Daniel Miller, the author within my book's point of view. Oh, I can use this to also talk about truth and storytelling. And you know, so of course it became far more useful to me in Homecoming, even than just as a way to convey the historical storyline. But that was something that occurred to me on the go rather than from the very beginning.
And you were writing that book, so I think you need to get royalties for that book as well. I think you need to get royalties because, I mean, believe me, as if they were asleep, it really feels like a book, everybody. And there's the ghostwriter right there. You know, your writing's got this slow burn, a slow reveal. Do you figure out what you're going to parse out as you're outlining or as you write? Because you don't get everything at once. And you get like, this is a little bit, and here's a little bit. And then we pull back, and then we go forward. And is that all part of your outlining, or is it just the way your brain works?
That part, I would say, I always think writing a book is equal parts and sort of brain work and you know, organization and intuition. And that part for me anyway, is intuition. I just know once I'm in the scene and I've telescoped down and I'm working and I'm seeing it, it's very clear to me. I don't have to think about whether I'll branch out into description or stay in dialogue. Of course, for me, the actual writing part, I'm really rigorous in that. I'm so envious of writers who say they switch off their internal editor and they just go with the flow and create the draft and then work on it. I do not have the ability to do that. I write a scene, I print it out, I read it, I hate it, I scribble all over it, I type the changes in, and then I print it again and I still hate it. And for each scene, I would do at least 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 versions of that. And as I'm doing it, it clarifies and the texture, the layers are added, the dialogue gets sharper, the description, I work out where there's too much and too little, the pace, all on a scene by scene level. And the benefit to that for me is that it becomes so real in that by the time I push on to the next scene, I'm dragging with me threads that have come to mind during that process. And what I'm leaving behind me is very solid and real and alive. Mm-hmm. And I, for whatever reason, need that, or else I lose faith with the book. So I need it to be of a certain texture and have enough layers for me to keep moving forward.
It's like you have the question and the answer. Like I've answered, I've posed another question. Now let's answer. Let's move in this direction. And I feel like I'm on a journey with your characters. I see the reveals with them. So I'm very connected to them because we're seeing it through their eyes. Is that what you're going for? Is that we're so, as a reader, so involved that we're saying, oh, look what the character had happened to them. We're part of it. Like we're part of that scene and what's going on.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think the, you know, you can write in first person, third person. For me, the most comfortable and enjoyable and almost necessary place to sit is in extremely close third person. Mm-hmm. So say with Percy in his prologue or Isabel in her prologue, we are reading third person, but we are them. We're in their mind. We're seeing their thoughts as they have them. And I really love to write that way because it helps exactly as you say. With Percy, we're on his journey. We're remembering his childhood. Our thoughts are with him as they drift, as all of our thoughts do, from one thing to another in our minds, you know, from one minute to the next. So that when he comes across that scene beneath the willow, we've been sort of transported with him as is life. You know, his thoughts are here and there, the past, the present. Suddenly this scene is before him and we are with him and we're mm-hmm. in that moment. Mm-hmm. And I love to write that way. And that was part of the challenge and a pleasant challenge for me in writing the book within Homecoming, because Daniel Miller does not write in that way. He mm-hmm. writes in a more distanced third person where he's describing what's happening and we're not quite in the minds of the characters in such a close way.
Yeah, it's like he's a journalist. It's like he's a journalist telling the story, whereas he's not the storyteller. He's telling a story, and there's a difference between telling a story and being a storyteller. And that's what I, you know, came across with this. You know, identity and who we belong to comes up a lot in this book. Some are hidden by secrets. Others make characters to long to be in different places. Diaries and written words give readers clues to what's going on. And I always think about the modern world where everything happens in text and everything happens. You're not going to find a house full of written scratch-offs, maybe your food shopping list, maybe you're not doing that on your computer. But I feel like we are not going to have some of these fabulous elements that were in your book, that somebody would find a journal, that somebody would find pieces torn out. Why were those pages missing? Right now, what do you have? Like, if you delete an email, no one knows you deleted it. So are you thinking about that? And where are, like, history is going to come in the future?
Yeah, that's such an interesting idea because, as you say, I mean, in terms of different genres, my book does borrow from the genre of Gothic, you know, with the embedded texts and the discovery of old notebooks and letters and things. And I do often think, you know, will the sort of romantic, enjoyable aspect of that be lost when we no longer leave those sorts of traces? But in terms of identity creation, I think the modern world opens a lot of new opportunity because, you know, social media, for example, is all about identity creation. It's almost like a branding exercise on an individual level. And that opens lots of opportunities for writers of the future. But in turn, yes, I mean, maybe, you know, you're going to have characters who know how to crack into old hard drives and, and find old online diaries. That is something I find quite interesting. When people have kept online diaries that they've left behind and they move on, but out there in the seemingly endless storage of cyberspace, those half-finished journals are drifting somewhere, waiting to be discovered by someone. So perhaps we are leaving more imprints than we realize.
Yeah, you know, sometimes I read back, we do a newsletter every Friday night, and I look back on the old ones, and I'm like, oh, remember we were doing that? And people say to me, why do you take pictures of, like, your holiday tables? I said, so I remember what I did so I can do it next year? Because I am not going to remember those little cute eggs for Easter, and I'm never going to remember those little bunnies or someplace, and now I can rip the house apart and try to find them. So but you're documenting your life in a very curated kind of a way. And we're going to get into your Instagram later because I find your Instagram is one of the most fun to follow. But first I want to look at what you talk about, families as small theater. And I love that line, and it's so true. So let's talk about, like, you get together with a family and you really are in some act of a play. And sometimes you repeat that same act a lot.
Yeah, it's so true. And you know, when I say that, I guess what I mean, because people often say, why do you write about families? And to me, everything in humanity you can find in the small theater of the family. You know, all the great passions and emotions that you would find in Shakespeare, you can reduce and find within a single family. And so that gives such a large palette to work with as a writer, let alone all of the other aspects of family. For instance, the fact that you are inextricably linked. You don't really get a choice about your family. So, you know, friends can choose to part ways, but with your family, you can't do that in quite the same way. And so it does, again, with the, I guess it's a Gothic idea, that tying together, the tethering of people one to the other, even through conflict and difference. And, you know, there's a lot, it's very fruitful to work with.
Right. Because every time, okay, we don't really believe him, but he's a very believable character. But the family has said, oh, I don't want to deal with him. But we as readers are saying, he's saying exactly what needs to be said right now. And the way everything comes together of how these people died, you don't find out till the very, very end. And it's just so interesting because it's who told who what. And you told these little pieces, and all the little pieces have to come together so you actually know what happened that day and why.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, everyone has scraps of the story, and you know, to create the whole story, you need everyone's small piece of information.
But I really love that Polly and Jess at the end were like, they were bonding, and they were on to, okay, let's go figure this out, and then we can get on together. We can get on together instead of just getting on apart. I liked where you left them. Was there one character that was easier to write than every other one? I'm taking a guess on one. Let me see.
Well, so in terms of easy to write, I have to mention Percy, first of all, because he was the first character I had, and he presented himself fully. And as I wrote the prologue, it was as if I was recording something about a real person, and I just knew all of that about him. So I loved writing him. I loved writing Isabel. We're only in her point of view briefly, but I enjoyed her very much. One of my favorites to write, and this will surprise you, I think, is Polly, because it's always easy and enjoyable to write big dynamic characters like Nora, who leaps off the page and she's got a lot to say. And, you know, she was great fun and she was very vivid to me from the beginning. But Polly, who's a quieter character, was more of a challenge and therefore more interesting to me to write, because the characters who want to tell you all about themselves, you know, you just let them do that. It's the characters who other people speak about and who don't let themselves be seen mm-hmm. as easily are the ones who present that challenge. And so I enjoyed writing her.
Yeah.
Now I'm keen to know which one you think I would have liked writing the most.
I thought you liked Jess. I thought you liked Jess because Jess was somebody who was going to be transplanted, was going to have to move it to this world. And then all of a sudden, kind of her thoughts about everybody were going to have to shift. And she's also in a place where she didn't have a job. She was not in a relationship. She had all this stuff falling apart. And then she gets down there and she's supposed to be like in charge, really. Like your grandmother's here and you're supposed to be in charge. She's like, wait a second. This isn't who I thought I was coming to see. And I didn't think that this is what was going to happen. And then what happened to her? And I felt like she would be a character that would be fun to write, because all of a sudden she's being presented in these situations that she's really in over her head on what to do. And this whole history and finding this book, and, you know, you're sitting in this house, which is kind of like, you know, creepy because it's big and all this kind of stuff. And you know, that there's this notebook, and then you're sitting and you're reading this book about what happened, and you're like, okay, yeah, it's all going to be fine. No worries for me. So that was my thought.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Jess is the main storyteller of Homecoming in a sense. I mean, she's the character who, aside from the prologue, she's the character we meet who in the present day, allows the story to be told. It sort of happens to her in a way. She's mm-hmm. the one who is called home. She's the one who all the themes about home and belonging center around her. You know, where do I belong? Where do I feel at home? What do I mean when I say that I feel at home? And she's the one for whom the overarching storyline, you know, she needed a resolution at the end to sort of come to some place that it was different from the one she was in at the beginning, which is quite an unsettled place. And I think she does achieve that. I mean, not all the loose ends are tied up, but I really loved writing the last chapter where she and Polly have that moment, which it's not a moment of absolute clarification, but it's still, I felt I had delivered Jess to a place of hope and possibility. And that's, you know,
but yeah, they could have a conversation where they could believe in each other. They could believe in each other, which before, I don't think that anything her mother said, she would have believed. And now she did something that made her believe in her mother, which I think is really interesting. This is also a book about books. And there's so many books that are cited throughout. There's a line that reading shapes a person. The landscape of books is more real in some ways than the one outside the window. So let's talk about that, because it's a great line of, reading does shape you, what you read, what you take away from it.
Absolutely. And I mean, that is something I experienced firsthand. You know, I was a reader long before I even thought that human beings could write books and have them published. So I came to writing as a voracious reader. I started reading before I went to school. My mum put labels up around the house and I learned to read pretty young. And I just fell in love. I'm sure, like you, probably most people hearing this conversation, I discovered that you open the covers, you go in the door, and you're in another world. And so I would finish a book before school. I would read in the car, even though it made me ill. I would read in the bathtub as a child. I, you know, my books were wet and they had things spilled on them. And, you know, so I was a reader. And the worlds that I read about, I mean, of course, some books were set in Australia, which was my real landscape as well. But many of them, for instance, were set in England. I loved Enid Blyton. I loved C.S. Lewis. You know, I went through the back of that wardrobe. I read Anne of Green Gables. You know, I read Trixie Belden. So I traveled, through my imagination so much as a child, so much that when I went to England for the first time when I was 17, I felt I knew it. I had already built this world in my imagination so vividly that it was like visiting somewhere I already knew. And I think, I mean, that's the power of books, isn't it? To transport us and to allow connection and communication. I never get over that idea that I conceive an idea and I write it down and I make a book, and then you pick it up and you read it across time and space, and you create a whole unique version of the story again, which belongs to you, and it's, so it's this conversation between you and me.
Right, right.
In which, these characters get to live again. I love that.
Yeah, it's such a satisfying feeling when you finish a book that you really loved, and it's like, oh, this was like, I see everything that happened. It's funny because I read before I went to school too, and they didn't believe me when I got to school. And I said, no, I know how to read. I was four. And I learned to read by sight, which both my boys have done as well. So they never sound out words. So Corey, my younger son, every once in a while comes over and says, epitome. And I go, no, it's epitome.
Me too.
These words.
And that exact word. It took me, I still have to say it in my mind before I say it out loud because I learned it off the page.
He said something, we were out to dinner and he said something. I said, what are you talking about? And I said, could you like spell that? Like what you're doing? But he's totally confident. He goes, I'm going to go get a pint of milk. I'm like, a pint of milk? A pint of milk. But he never learned to say, and he just sat down and read. And he read through middle school, and then required reading came, and that was the end of that. And it was a shame because there was so much more reading to do. Maybe someday I'll come back to it. But
that it's such a tricky one. I mean, so when I was growing up, we had the rule, like I suppose, most polite families have the rule not to read at the dinner table because you're there to be with your family. My kids all want to read at the table. And, in this day and age when, to have a child read a book instead of, do some kind of other, exactly, screen time, I just have to allow the reading because I'm so excited to see it. And the last thing I want to do is stop people from reading. So,
Yeah, it's a quieter dinner. It's a quieter dinner.
I mean, not all the time, but, if you're in the middle of a good book.
You don't want to stop. You don't want to stop. You don't want to come downstairs. I still have all his books in the closet upstairs. And I said, well, what do you want to do with these? He goes, don't touch them. He goes, they're still mine. I'm like, you haven't left home in 5 years, but nope. So in every family, there are also secrets. And those are the things that can either bring people together, like you've got a secret that you've all got to keep, or they can tie them up or tear you apart. And here there's so many secrets, and each is revealed. We understand what's happening a bit more, but not completely until the end. When you're plotting, you're kind of reeling us in. It's like, okay, and then I'm going to go this way, and I'm going to pull you back. And I just find is that that's just as you sit down and write from what you said before. That's just your stream of consciousness. You're not sitting there going, and now in chapter 14, we're going to take them here. Doesn't work like that?
No, I mean, I do. I plot some of it out, but I do get a real sense for when I need to pull up the end of the chapter or drop a clue or how to sort of entice readers through. A lot of that is just intuition as I'm writing, and it just feels this is the right spot. And so I go with that flow.
From your Instagram feed, I see your love of beautiful things, be it flowers, trees, a sunset. And from this love, I see your writing is so descriptive, but also for anybody following you on Instagram, you're writing like next to this is a sunset. And this is what it's not just this is a sunset. This is how I felt when I was there. This is what I was communicating. And you take readers to these places. And I feel like drawing the scenes for us ensures we're caught up in the action. And I think that the detail there is what makes your book so compelling, because it's not just where Percy is not just in the field. We feel the heat. We feel whatever. Yeah. And it doesn't happen in just one scene. Sometimes you're reading a book and it's done well here, but it's not done well here. And this is the reason it's this size is because it's done well throughout of telling the story, if that makes sense.
Well, thank you, Carol. Yeah, I mean, I'm a feeler. And so, and I'm a communicator, and it's very important to me to communicate, exactly how I feel and how it feels. And so those aspects are important to me. I know there are some readers for whom that isn't important to their enjoyment of the book, and who, every so often I'll read, you know, someone will have written a review and say, oh, I just skimmed through the
setting.
I think, oh, well, you know, it's there if you want. You can go back and read it. For me, I do love to know how things feel and the way they smell and the way they look. And that is important to me. So that is an important part of the scene setting and the sense of place, you know, mm-hmm. making it real. It's not just a sunset. It's this kind of sunset.
Right.
So yeah, for me, that's just a part of my narrative language.
When I was looking at the pictures on Instagram, I could see that they were scenes that were described in the book. And there are the trees that are like this. And here's the sunset off to the left. And this is how it looked when the storm was coming in. And you really felt that, like, you knew how to write those descriptions. Because when I was looking at the pictures, which I did today, it's like, oh, I can identify with that of working with the book. I think of you as being brilliant at entertaining and decorating. Are those two things you enjoy?
I am very aesthetic. So I do love, you know, I can't sit in a room without noticing and wanting to rearrange. And I do get great joy from beauty in all different aspects. And in terms of entertaining, I wish I were a better cook. I think I'm a little too precise with my approach to cooking. You know, if I have a recipe, I have to measure everything out, and that's not the way I want it to be. I love it. My sister and my mom are amazing cooks, and they'll throw this in and that in, and, you know, make these tablefuls of food. So I'm a very good guest.
You're a good guest. You're a good guest. One of my friends used to say she was very good at presenting the food. She's, I present food beautifully. I don't cook, I present, you know? So there you go. There you go.
Yeah, I can present the location.
Yeah, but, that's exactly.
If someone else will bring the food.
I'll do the table. I'll do everything. So for you, when you moved into this home in Australia, it was a rental home. Was it something that you decided you were going to, you know, buy or whatever? So you're in this place. Do you feel like you had to decorate it before you could do everything? Because even when we rent a house at the beach, I'm moving everything around. That couch is not staying there. It's moving. It's like really funny.
Yeah, I can't switch that off. You know, it does bring me joy. You know, even as a child, I would set aside a particular weekend. I'd say, right, I'm rearranging my room today. And so, because it changes how you feel, mm-hmm. you know, the way I very much, it's not just that I believe it, I know it, that the aesthetics around you change the way you see the world and the way you feel about things. And so that is, that's why it's wonderful to be in nature, isn't it?
Yes,
because it
yes.
changes the way you feel. It changes the way your body responds. Real. That's science.
I was at a conference 2 weeks ago and I came back and everything is green in the backyard. And I was like, wait, what happened? And it was a totally different palette than what I'd left. It was almost like 90 degrees, which is where everything got forced. But it was so weird to look out the window and not see the gray and brown that I've been used to and see this lush of color. And I feel like that's the kind of thing that you would be describing, is like all of a sudden the color burst out and things like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
So their chapter titles and the book is divided into 9 parts. Did you have those in mind, or were those things you changed back? And they're beautiful little pieces in this. Let me see if I can find this. And this is like part, I don't know if I would be able to show this. You can see it just a little bit. But they're wonderful design elements in the book. They're beautiful little design elements. Did you know, like, why are these parts? Like, but if I go back and I take this apart and I look at it, part one is this, part two is this. Mm. And in your early plotting, did you know part 1, 2, 3?
Mm-mm. No, I didn't. So I write in the order that the words appear in the book, but towards the end of the structural edit, I think I inserted the parts partly to help myself know that, you know, that because each part has a slightly different mood and a new discovery and moves, whether it's featuring a particular character more than they'd been in a previous part. So it helped me to keep the structure in mind. And I was in two minds about whether to remove the parts and just let the book flow once it went to print, or to leave them. And in the end, I decided to leave them because in consultation, I decided to leave them because I think they're helpful to a reader as well. It can be nice to know this is a spot where you can take a breath. Particularly in a book as long as Homecoming, and as long as all my books end up being, it's useful to, you know, to sort of tell us to show those moments where it's okay to take a pause now.
It's okay. And they're also little chapters.
Not for too long.
It's Sydney, yes. You know, December 11th, 2018, you know where you are. I also found myself bringing out a map because I don't know Australia back, you know, back and forth. And I was looking at this and I was, so this is where Adelaide Hills are. And this is where the, what is it, Tambourine Mountain, Queensland is where you grew up. And yes. I was just looking at where these places are, like how far apart are they from each other? Oh, they're actually in different parts of the country. And they're parts of the country you can't actually drive through because there's no gas. My children have told me this, like you have to carry everything with you, which I feel like we'll be doing at some point. And I feel like it's a vast country with wildlife that is unique to it in its own sense of place, according to where you are. So where you are, where the story is set, is very different than would have been if it was up in the mountain. It would have been a different kind of landscape. And every once in a while, a kangaroo did come through to make me realize, oh, look, that is the, you know, part of the landscape here. But maybe long to visit it all the more. People say, where would you like to go? And I say, Australia. Believe it or not, that's a one, a 24-hour flight. I'm there for it, folks. But, you know, I just think that's the landscape and the change in, you know, what's happening. But I feel like I've read so many books that are set there that I just love the, this is what the land is like.
Yeah, you definitely must come. But you're absolutely right. I mean, it's a very large continent. And so in similar to the US, there are vastly different geographical locations. So the mountains where I grew up, which is midway down the East Coast, it's subtropical. So it's palm groves and, you know, rich iron red dirt from the erupted volcanoes and mist and hot, humid summers. Whereas the Adelaide Hills, which we actually do drive between the two, but it's a 24-hour drive.
Wow. Okay.
It's incredible. You would be familiar in the US with that sort of road trip, but it's a long drive and you drive south and down to the middle of the country. And there it's a Mediterranean climate. So by that, I mean, it's a wine growing region. It's instead of wet, humid summers, it's dry, hot summers. That's where you'll get your bushfires. It's wet, cold winters. So, you know, very different, different gum trees. When I'm down at the Adelaide Hills, there are kangaroos everywhere. I see them all the time. You know, I'll be driving and there'd be a group of six or seven in a paddock. So, you know, sort of before moving on. So, there, you know, we have a koala called Kevin on our farm. So, you know, that wildlife is around. But yes, vastly different landscapes, even within the one country.
Yeah, within one continent of going back and forth. You were working on another book, and when you pivoted to this one, if I remember correctly, that's not the only book you've ever put aside. I think you've put a few beside of one. Do you think you'll ever go to those pages again, or do you see yourself just doing something new?
It's such a tricky one because, you know, I can open up that old file and, you know, there's quite a lot in there. I think I'd written about 20,000 words. The characters were so real to me, but even though I can read and think, yeah, there's a lot here, and I had it all plotted out and all sorts of themes and ideas and layers that were going to appear, and they're all written down there, but I can't feel it. And if it doesn't live and breathe anymore, I know it will just feel like a paint-by-numbers exercise. And that's just not the way I want to feel when I'm writing. I think readers can tell when they're reading a book that was written in that sort of perfunctory way. Mm-hmm. And so it loses that interest. So if I can reignite that feeling for the book, then yes, I would definitely pick it up and jump back in. But the thing is, there are ideas everywhere. And so new ideas come. And you know, I always think a book is like a time capsule of the author's life during the period they're writing it. And everything that you feel and think and see and do finds a way. It's not autobiographical, but they find a way in there. And, you know, for me anyway, I'm following my own human interests when I write a book. Mm-hmm. The veil between it and me is very thin. And I'm a new person now from the one I was 5 years ago or 10 years ago. And my interests and passions have changed as well, my way of looking at the world. I mean, we've all been through collectively such an enormous time of change and reconsideration that I have new ways of looking at the world that I want to pursue and, sort of fold into my book. So I imagine that probably I'm more likely to come up with new ideas and follow a new story for now.
Isn't it interesting? And you can just say, okay, I spent that time, put it away. I mean, we talked to Kristen Hanna last night, and she said she was, I think she said like some crazy way into the book before she decided that the main character was Elsa and it wasn't the daughter. And she just chucked it all out and started it from here. And it's very interesting when you really feel that. And there are a lot of writers that still will keep going. They'll see people on that book a year, we got to do it, da 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 da, and it's not there. And sometimes I can read and go, it's not there. It just, it didn't, there were all these characters, but it didn't, you know, get me in. And I think that the time and the time to let things gel and mold is like really important. So.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a luxury. It feels like a luxury to be able to set that aside and pursue, because if, as you say, if you were having to write and publish a book every year, there isn't time to make that sort of decision. But I don't know what Kristen said, but for me, when you have that sort of realization, it's not painful to set the old aside. I mean, yes, of course, it's always, you know, you've spent months on something, but the excitement at the revelation that, oh, it's this character and that's what I have to do is so stimulating and wonderful that it's just a relief to get rid of the bit that was holding you back and pursue the place where the genuine passion is leading you. And so for me, it's not as dire as it sounds to have to set aside old work.
It is what it is. Likewise, you pivoted to Australia. Are you planning to stay there now? Or you think are you there for the period of time?
For the time. I mean, I like Jess, like so many of the characters I write about, will always have a shared, a sort of split identity. You know, I feel that I belong in more than one place. And so that's a wonderful privilege to be able to feel that way and to have lived in more than one place. But it also means you're always permanently slightly unsettled, because when I'm in one place, I miss the other. But, you know, that's how my life and my sense of belonging is. But for now, yes, we are here because, I mean, I have school-aged children and they need that sort of stability. And, you know, it's wonderful to be near family and
to have them
have
that.
That brings.
Even 24 hours in the car to go see them. It's okay. You know, it's not a problem. It's not a problem. You know, we're both the moms of boys. And when we last met, we talked about that. And I do think that raising boys is different than raising girls. And I kept thinking, if Polly and Jess were boys, how different the story would have been. There would have been a lot less words. There would have been a lot less dialogue. And it would have been more like, what are you kidding? Like, of course we're going to do that. Like, it would have been a totally different. And I don't know if you feel that way, because I feel like you know how to write these women so well. But it's just so funny, because if boys were in that same situation, and you saw it with a couple of male characters, like, I'm just going to call it the way I see it. And whereas you're writing these women that have these lush lives, and this is what's going on. Am I right? It's like, you're passionate.
Yeah, well, it's so interesting because I am one of three sisters, and my mom is one of three sisters, and her mom was one of six sisters. So there's a lot of women in our family. And then it's like, you know, life has a way of balancing things out. So I have three sons. So it's great. I've been able to experience both. But certainly, you know, the world that I grew up in with sisters was very female. And so I do find that a very, I like to write about women and women's stories. And so often, particularly in larger scale historical periods, you know, the wars, that it's often those stories that don't make it into the, you know, the official history book. So I think it's important every opportunity we have to illuminate the lives of women in the period. That is a good thing to do. Plus, you know, I just love to write women's, I don't even want to say women's stories. They're women, they're female characters,
but
they're stories that everybody can enjoy.
So, you know, it's really funny, because you even think about just these women that you see for a very short time in 1959, you feel like you knew Isabel. You feel like you knew everything about her and what was going on. And she had a complete life on that page and what she was planning to do. And it was just a very, very interesting that each of them has their own complete personality that's drawn through. And sometimes it's shortened. Sometimes an author only takes it to here, but you took it here all the time. So.
Oh, I'm glad. I mean, even if a character's only on the page for a brief period, I think it's still important to find the things the aspects of their character that will still make them, come to full life. I mean, they deserve that, even if they're there only briefly.
Yeah, only for a couple of seconds, you know. So the first book in 5 years, do you think we'll see the next one sooner? Or Carol, talking in 5 years.
Yes, unless I start another one, put it aside, a pandemic happens, we change countries, then I think I can say it will be sooner than that.
That'd be really good. What is, like, was this always the title? Was Homecoming always the title?
Yeah, it was.
And it worked in all three countries, which was interesting, the original countries. Because sometimes they change it to something else because it's going to work. But those, and let's talk about the cover. The covers in all the three different countries are very different. One has got aqua, which is like my favorite color. So I was like, you know, way into that. But was this the cover they presented you with, or did you play around with it? Because I feel like you have an artistic bent as well.
There were a few other options first, they're always beautiful, but you sort of receive an email and you know it's going to be a cover suggestion. And I always hesitate a moment and think, oh, please, please love it. Right. And I'll open it. And with this one, it opened and I just knew instantly. And I mean, first of all, it is beautiful. I think it's objectively, it's a beautiful cover. But for me, that is the feeling of how I feel when I'm reading. You know, you open a book, there's the promise of the story inside, and you just let yourself go down that tunnel towards the story. But even though it has all sorts of more literal applications, like, you know, coming home and the light at the end of the tunnel, for me, it's about come in here, open the book, and disappear inside the world of the story.
Exactly. And feel the texture of the words, the texture of the words, and the sensory experience as well. That was absolutely beautiful and cover. Absolutely great. So the audio is narrated by Claire Foy. And was that your selection? Like, tell me how that came to be.
Yeah, I'm so fortunate that Claire Foy was available to read, because of course, I mean, she's, you know, a wonderful actress and such a wonderful voice. So, I mean, I love to think that people will get to, you know, listen to her beautiful voice and her incredible reading skills and performance skills as they listen, and she brings the world of Tambula to life.
Yes, I listened to just a little clip and I just was mesmerized by her voice. I was like, oh, maybe I'll sit there and just read and listen next. Well, this has been, as always, a pleasure. I always love talking to you, even though it takes 5 years in between. And we must do this like more often because it's such fun. And I just love the book. And I tell you, I will just tell people, just put this in your hands and read it. And, you know, people are going to say it's long and this and the other thing. And I'm just like, you know what? Just take this one and make this one your experience. And then go out and really think about how the book was constructed and what went into it. Because I think besides being a beautiful experience, I think it's something that people can take away and learn from. Of this is how an author writes and this is what she does. So,
Carol, thank you so much. It's such a joy to speak to you. And you've been such a champion for Homecoming, but also for writers and books everywhere. Thank you so much.
You're so kind. You make the job very, very easy. I have great things to talk about. So thank you. And I look forward to seeing you next time.
Indeed, it's a date.
It's a date. And to our readers, look forward to seeing you next time. Remember, you can find us. Book Reporter Talks To is where our interviews are on podcast, and our YouTube channel is the Book Report Network. So thank you so much for joining us, everybody. Keep listening for an audio excerpt from Homecoming by Kate Morton, narrated by Claire Foy, coming up after the credits, courtesy of Belinda Audio. The show has been produced by Jordan Red Productions. Thank you for listening to Book Reporter Talks To. Don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode. Support us by sharing on social media or by telling a friend about us. And we look forward to next time on Book Reporter Talks To. And now, hear an audio excerpt from Homecoming, narrated by Claire Foy, coming up after the credits, courtesy of Belinda Audio.
Belinda presents this unabridged recording of Homecoming, written by Kate Morton and read by Claire Foy. Prologue, Adelaide Hills, South Australia, New Year's Day, 1959. And of course, There was to be a lunch party to mark the new year. A small affair, just family, but Thomas would require all the trimmings. Unthinkable that they would do otherwise. The Turners were big on tradition, and with Nora and Richard visiting from Sydney, neither frippery nor fanfare was to be skipped. Isabel had decided to set up in a different part of the garden this year. Usually they sat beneath the walnut tree on the eastern lawn, but today she'd been drawn to the stretch of grass in the shade of Mr. Wentworth's cedar. She'd walked across it when she was cutting flowers for the table earlier and been struck by the pretty westward view towards the mountains. Yes, she'd said to herself, this will do very well. The arrival of the thought, her own decisiveness, had been intoxicating. She told herself it was all part of her New Year's resolution, to approach 1959 with a fresh pair of eyes and expectations. But there was a small internal voice that wondered whether she wasn't rather tormenting her husband just a little with the sudden breach of protocol. Ever since they'd discovered the sepia photograph of Mr. Wentworth and his similarly bearded Victorian friends, arranged in elegant wooden recliners on the eastern lawn, Thomas had been immovable in his conviction that it represented the superior entertaining spot. It was unclear to Isabel exactly when she'd first started taking guilty pleasure in causing that small vertical frown line to appear between her husband's brows. A gust of wind threatened to rip the string of bunting from her hands, and she held tight to the highest rung of the wooden ladder. She'd carried the ladder down from the gardening shed herself that morning, quite enjoying the struggle of it. When she first climbed to the top, a childhood memory had come to her. A day trip to Hampstead Heath with her mother and father, where she'd scrambled up one of the giant sequoia trees and looked south towards the City of London. I can see St. Paul's, she called down to her parents when she spotted the familiar dome through the smog. Don't let go, her father had called back. It wasn't until the moment he said it that Isabel had felt a perverse urge to do just that. The desire had taken her breath away. A clutch of galahs shot from the top of the thickest banksia tree, a panic of pink and grey feathers, and Isabel froze. Someone was there. She'd always had a powerfully developed instinct for danger. You must have a guilty conscience, Thomas used to say to her back in London when they were new to one another and still entranced. Nonsense, she'd said. I'm just unusually perceptive. Isabel stayed motionless at the top of the ladder and listened. There now, look, came the stage whisper. Hurry up and kill it with the stick. I can't. You can, you must. You took an oath. But it was only the children, Matilda and John. A relief, Isabel supposed. Nonetheless, she remained quiet so as not to give herself away. Just snap its neck and get it over with. That was Evie, her youngest, at 9. I can't. Oh, John, said Matilda, 14 going on 24. Give it here. Stop being such a pill.